Relevant and insightful conversations about health and medicine happen here on MedStar Health Doc Talk. 2.5 years after Chadwick Boseman walked the red carpet at the Hollywood premiere of Black Panther, the Marvel superhero was dead. He had lost his private 4-year battle with colon cancer at the age of 43. While Boseman's death shocked the world, the industry, and his fans, it also spotlighted a growing trend. More and more people under the age of 55 are getting diagnosed with colorectal cancer. Today on MedStar Health Doc Talk, we'll talk with gastroenterologist Dr. Dana Sloan about the latest developments in screening for colorectal cancer and what you need to know about signs, symptoms, and treatment. I'm your host, Deborah Schindler. Dr. Sloan, thank you for being our guest on MedStar Health Doc Talk.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The term colorectal cancer is one we hear often, especially in March, the designated awareness month. It really is a term that umbrellas multiple cancers. It can't really be viewed as one disease, can it?
It can't. The umbrella term is useful in terms of just having a phrase to which everyone can apply the disease. But we do think about colon cancer and rectal cancer a bit differently in terms of diagnosis and treatment. Gastroenterologists, oncologists, surgeons will often sometimes also treat left-sided cancers and right-sided cancers of the colon a little bit differently. There is some thought process that left-sided colon cancers are in fact genetically and clinically different than those from the right side of the colon. So there's definitely distinct disease processes that are encompassed by the term colorectal cancer.
But let's go through those, what the colorectal cancers include.
So rectal cancer is considered to be a cancer of the left side of the colon. Of course, the rectum is the last 10 or 20 centimeters of the colon. So it is the part that holds the stool before it's passed out, but it is considered to be part of the left side of the colon. The reason that we will sometimes differentiate it in the medical community is that the signs of rectal cancer can be different than cancers higher up in the colon, and certainly the treatment of rectal cancer is very different. Rectal cancer is actually more treatable in some ways, more responsive to treatment in some ways than cancers of the rest of the colon. But again, for your listeners, colorectal cancer can still be treated as one entity when it comes to screening.
Is bowel cancer the same thing as colon cancer?
Essentially, I think about bowel. When I hear the term bowel, it really can encompass anything from the stomach, the small intestines, to the colon. So it's a bit less specific of a term.
Okay.
But certainly those terms have been used interchangeably.
What about sigmoid cancer?
So the sigmoid portion of the colon is the S shape or the curvy part of the left colon. It's still encompassed by the term left-sided colon cancer.
What causes colorectal cancer? Since Chadwick Boseman's brother later revealed that he has also been battling cancer, can we say that genetics is a big factor?
Unquestionably, genetics plays a role. And when folks hear the term average risk for colorectal cancer, high risk for colorectal cancer, one of the main known or well-established risk factors for colorectal cancer is family history. So we know that genetics plays a very strong part, but by no means is that the only risk factor. It is, knowing that colorectal cancer has a genetic component is the reason why we tell our patients, understand your family history, talk to your parents, talk to your siblings, talk to your children, because there's unquestionably a genetic component. But there are identical twins, wherein one person will have colon cancer, the other twin will never even have a polyp. So we know that genetics doesn't tell the whole story.
So when is a good time for someone to see a genetic counselor then? Does the patient, the one who has the diagnosis, go see the counselor, or do their family members?
So fortunately, your doctor would be able to give you guidance in that regard. At a center, a multidisciplinary center like MedStar Franklin Square or the MedStar entities in general, when a person comes in and is diagnosed with a colorectal cancer, it is the diagnosing and treating physician who will make that recommendation to say, Ms. Deb, you have colon cancer, and based on your results, based on the analysis of your tumor, we do recommend that you and your family be seen by a genetic counselor. So that's not something that the patient themselves has to navigate and negotiate. Your doctor can give you recommendations about that.
In the spirit of prevention, Let's go through the list of some other possible causes. Mm-hmm.
So beyond genetics, again, family history is very, very important. We do think that there are other modifiable risk factors, such as obesity, such as diet, thinking that a diet that's higher in fiber and lower in fat can be protective against colon polyps and cancer. Smoking can certainly be a risk factor for colon polyps, which are the precursors to colorectal cancer. Having other underlying colon diseases, like inflammatory bowel disease, can be another risk. What can a patient do to reduce those risks? Well, they work on those risk factors. So again, beyond understanding their own family history, to look at the rest of their health. Am I a smoker? Am I getting a diet that's very high in saturated fats and low in fiber? Am I getting my fruits and my veggies? Have I been diagnosed with a condition like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, and I should talk to my doctor about higher risk screening? These are some of the factors that a patient can look at when thinking about their own personal risk of colon cancer.
You know, you mentioned cigarette smoking. And the longer I do these podcasts, the more I realize that there's almost no part of your health that isn't impacted by cigarette smoking.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that depending on where the cancer grows, and when we are saying colorectal cancer could be in the colon, in the rectum, in the sigmoid.
So there's really four main sections of the colon, if we can think about it that way. There's the right side of the colon, the transverse part of the colon, which is kind of the upper portion, and then the left side of the colon, which includes the sigmoid, as you're mentioning, and the descending colon and the rectum. And those are kind of in order of how the stool passes through the colon. So again, there is evolving evidence that suggests that cancer that develops on the right side of the colon is genetically and distinctly different from cancer that develops on the left side of the colon. Are there different genes that are involved? Are there different cancer evolution in terms of how the cells develop that happens on the right side versus the left side? These are things that are not yet well understood, but there's certainly evidence that suggests that it is. Unfortunately, we're seeing this changing landscape of colorectal cancer, as you alluded to earlier, seeing it in younger people and seeing it in younger people at more advanced stages. And that can't be accounted for by just delayed screening alone. So we do think that there is significant physiologic changes that are happening in terms of colorectal cancer development.
Could it be environmental? Could it be the food that we are eating?
Could absolutely be a factor. My mother loves to say, food was just different back in the days when I was a girl. And the truth of it is, I think that we probably underestimate the impact of diet and how much our food is processed. To your earlier point about smoking and how it does, there's not a single system that smoking does not impact. Our diet is very, very powerful. And so there's probably a lot of factors that right now may be intangible that in the future may be better understood in terms of its risk in terms of colon cancer development.
So I thought it was interesting that you said, depending on where the cancer is, the symptoms could be different. What typically are the symptoms? What should people be wary of if they have, say, cancer in the sigmoid? Because 70%, I read, 70% of colorectal cancers are in that area of the colon.
And that number may be changing depending upon which patient population we look at. Again, certain populations in whom we're seeing more right-sided colon cancers. And that can be true, for example, for some of our younger patients. But I think the most important thing for our listeners to understand is that the most common symptom of colon cancer is no symptom at all. So the fact that we have to be intentional about screening is the most important, really the key thing. Most patients who have colon cancer or colorectal cancer are never going to have any symptoms. And this is why we have to go screening, go looking for this disease, much in the way of a mammogram, So many women won't feel a lump, right? But they go in for the mammogram and that's when they find the cancer. So, all of our patients understand that we have to go screening for colorectal cancer is really critical. Yes, some patients will have symptoms such as rectal bleeding. What does that mean? Blood in the stool, blood in the toilet bowl. They may have abdominal pain. They may have some change in their bowel habits, such as new constipation, or just a change in the caliber and the size of their stools. Some people will have weight loss at more advanced stages of the disease. For some of my younger patients who've come with colon cancer, they've had no symptoms, but their primary care provider has found, they're becoming more anemic. Their red blood cells are low, and that's how they end up getting to their colon cancer diagnosis. I think that the intimidating thing about colorectal cancer is that it typically does not have symptoms. And this is why we urge patients to get screened and be intentional about it.
That's a really scary thought when you consider that and we haven't gotten to this part yet, but that the routine screenings really aren't available until you're 45.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The screening age was lowered in the U.S. from 50 to 45 several years ago. And truth be told, we're probably not capturing many patients who, you know, probably should be screened earlier. But this is why, again, it's important for patients to talk with their families and understand their own history, their own family history, and to pay attention to their bodies because, you know, a recommendation is just that. It's a general recommendation for the overall population. When it comes down to the individual, I think, you know, all of our patients need to pay attention to their bodies and their symptoms because you may fall outside of that recommendation parameter. But, you know, colorectal cancer screening is indeed widely available. I think that, you know, patients need to understand what some of their options are, but there should be nothing standing between a patient and getting effective screening for colon cancer.
So let's talk about some of those options. First off, what's an early diagnosis, would you say? What's an early diagnosis of colorectal cancer? Are they staged 1, 2, 3, 4?
Yes, they are staged in that way. I know I would defer to my oncology colleagues to give more of the details about that. But in general, stage 1 colon cancer is localized to the colon, meaning it hasn't spread beyond that. Stage 2 can imply that the colon cancer is spread into like the lymph nodes nearby the colon, so a bit more advanced. Stage 3 disease is where there's more regional disease. So perhaps, you know, somewhere in the pelvis, again, near the colon, adjacent to the colon. And stage 4 disease, again, implies widespread disease, cancer that's throughout the body. And one of the more common places for colon cancer to metastasize or spread is the liver. So in general, you know, stage 1 is the earliest stage. But I think it's important for your listeners to know that, you know, colon cancer can also be prevented in some cases, by effective, you know, high quality colonoscopy, because in that case, we're able to find a polyp before it can become a colon cancer, or find colon cancer when it's confined to a polyp. So in which case, a polypectomy or polyp removal can be curative. So those are really, you know, our success stories. When gastroenterologists think about, you know, how do I prevent someone from developing colon cancer? I want to catch a cancer before it's really even a cancer. I want to catch those precancerous lesions.
I've read about a new stool test that appears to detect colorectal cancer precursors better than a current FIT test.
So you're probably talking about Cologuard, which is kind of the newer generation FIT test, if you will. So it's going beyond just screening for blood in the stool, which is really the basis by which FIT detects colon cancer and advanced colon polyps. But Cologuard is actually detecting DNA or genetic abnormalities in the colon. So the idea is that it can be more specific for colon cancers and advanced colon polyps. Increasingly available. I remember when it was first introduced, you know, years ago, it was, I won't say impossible, but very, very difficult to get Cologuard approved by a person's insurance company. But now it is an approved method of a modality for screening. A general perception that stool-based colon cancer screening is gross. You know, oh, I don't want to touch my poop. But, you know, the truth of the matter is none of these tests require you to go in and play in the toilet bowl. Right. There is a very streamlined way of collecting a stool sample, much in the way as someone will collect a urine sample when they go to their primary care doctor's office. So different bodily fluid, yes, you know, but, you know, it actually is a very clean, very straightforward way of, you know, getting to a colon cancer screening option. And unlike the older generation, occult blood for stool and FIT tests that had to be done annually, the Cologuard, so the newer generation stool tests, only have to be done every 3 years or so. So there's an advantage there as well.
Okay, here's the options that I've listed. Mm-hmm. We have the high sensitivity guaiac fecal occult blood test, or fecal immunochemical test.
It's a mouthful.
And you're supposed to do that every year?
Right. So the guaiac tests, which is, I know, all these crazy
names. I
should
have checked with you before we hit record.
But the guaiac tests are kind of the old school occult blood tests. So these are the tests that would sometimes require 3 different stool samples in a year. Not the most convenient testing for many patients. There are some dietary restrictions associated with that. You can't have red meat, for example, during the testing period. It was really looking for blood in the stool. And those tests would even pick up on, again, if you had a rare steak, you know, dietary or ingested blood. The newer generation, yes, is the fecal immunochemical test, which is going to be more specific for colonic blood. Only 1 stool sample required. And yes, that would have to be done annually as well.
Okay, the next one is the stool DNA FIT, which is supposedly done 1 to 3 years.
Right, so that's the Cologuard test we were talking about earlier. Does require a slightly larger stool sample than the FIT test and the occult aquiac, but that can be done every 3 years.
Then the computed tomography, colonography?
Mm-hmm. So CT colonography is virtual colonoscopy. Your readers and your listeners may have heard about that. That is a test wherein a CAT scan is done of the lining of the colon. So a patient would still have to complete a laxative to cleanse the colon. Then a CAT scan is done to look at the lining of the colon. It is sensitive to detect polyps as small as 5 millimeters in size. So it's a very sensitive test. The downside there is that you've gone through the laxative preparation and they can detect polyps, but nothing can be done at the time of the exam. So if a polyp is found on that study, the follow-up colonoscopy is still needed.
Because it's just a visual test.
Correct. Correct.
And that's every 5 years. Why
Correct.
Would people maybe opt for that over doing the colonoscopy? Is there an advantage?
So as a gastroenterologist, I can tell you there's two main pools of patients for whom I'll recommend that. One is the patient who has a history of colon polyps, but for whoever, whatever reason is too sick to undergo a colonoscopy in terms of getting the sedation or going through the laxative process. So a good option for them. Not A FIT test wouldn't be appropriate in that situation because we know that they've had polyps. We want to go and look for more. But the second category of patients who might get a virtual colonoscopy are the patients who had a failed colonoscopy. So the patient came in, and for whatever reason, they have a very large hernia. For example, the colon colonoscope can't be safely passed through their colon. They might be a more appropriate candidate for virtual colonoscopy. Virtual colonoscopy, again, is CAT scan-based, so there is some radiation involved. So it's really not a testing modality that we think of as first line for most patients to get screened.
Okay, next, the flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years and the same test every 10 years plus an annual FIT test. That I assume that's somebody who's doing both the Cologuard and the...
Yep, so knowing that the incidence of right-sided colorectal cancers is increasing over the years, and we talked about that a little bit earlier, the relying on flexible sigmoidoscopy, which is a look only at the left side of the colon, is really falling out of favor because we know that we are leaving out 50% of the colon where there's a fairly high incidence of colorectal cancer. So again, with this changing landscape of colorectal cancer and where these tumors arise in the colon, flexible sigmoidoscopy with or without a FIT test is really falling out of favor.
Okay, well, that brings us to colonoscopy. So let's go there.
Mm-hmm. Let's go there.
Give us a brief description of the screening. Who should get it? And if someone hasn't had one in 10 years or is concerned about getting one because of the hype that they've heard for years, can you give them any hope of there being improvements to the process?
Colonoscopy is an outpatient procedure. So you come in, you have it done, you go home. It is a test done under sedation. So there is a burden on the patient in that they can't work that day and they do need someone to drive them home afterwards. I tell all my patients, the colonoscopy is not the hard part. A colonoscopy is difficult because of the day beforehand. The day beforehand is a person's prep day. So they do follow a clear liquid diet for 24 hours and they drink a laxative. If there's any improvement over the past two decades, is that there are newer generation laxative preparations that are not quite as hateful as what we had, 20 and 30 years ago. We can use things like Miralax-based preps that don't have any taste or grit or texture. It's a lot to drink and it's a lot to poop, and there's really no getting around that. But, I tell my patients that, just like mammography, pap smears, prostate checks, there's no such thing as a perfect screening test. Colonoscopy has the advantage of being a high quality screening test and also a preventative test, again, in terms of looking for polyps and taking those out. And the quality of the colonoscopy really is tightly correlated with how well you're cleaned out. So the prep, while it's the most difficult part of the process, is the most important part of the process. The good news is that for our average risk patients who don't have any family history of colon cancer, don't have any personal history of polyps themselves, you have a high quality colonoscopy and you are rid of us for 10 years. It's only an every 10 year exam.
This is going to sound silly, but I think there is also an aversion by some people, including myself, years ago, before I knew how the process actually happens, how the procedure plays out, that you're on a table, butt up in the air, like in this, on your knees with your butt up in the air. And I think that people are really afraid of that.
you know, and I'm smiling at you, but I understand what you're saying. You know, I have a brother who's 57 this year, and when it was time for his colonoscopy, he was horrified, you know. He just didn't want to have it. And I think that there's some natural fearfulness, right? So there's some natural anxiety surrounding a procedure that involves a camera going in your rear end, of course, right? But, you know, I would have our listeners understand that colonoscopy is done with a person laying on their left side, kind of knees slightly bent towards their chest, no butt in the air, you know. There is an open back gown, for sure, but your butt stays firmly on the table.
And they are covered before?
Yes, absolutely, before and after, and, you know, minimally uncovered during the procedure. I will say immediately before the procedure, they're meeting with their gastroenterologist and their anesthesiologist. Again, they get some twilight sedation during the procedure. It's actually not a painful procedure, to be honest with you. I have actually done unsedated colonoscopies in the past.
I didn't know that was an option.
You know, there are some patients who unfortunately don't have social support, so they don't have someone to drive them home. They don't have the ability to make those arrangements. And in those cases, yeah, we can do an unsedated colonoscopy. Now, I will say, it's like being very, very gassy, very, very bloated. So it's not comfortable in that regard. And that's why we recommend sedation for most patients. But even though, you know, a patient has to relinquish some control in that situation and be under sedation for those 15 or 20 minutes, they're completely comfortable. And then when you wake up fully covered and recovered in the post-procedure area.
How long is the procedure?
About 15 to 20 minutes. It's very short.
When you said that, I thought I must have misheard you.
No, that's 15 really to 20 fast. Minutes. Yeah, absolutely. It's a very short procedure. So, you know, I tried to emphasize, maybe overemphasize, the fact that the colonoscopy is the relatively easy part. It's the prep day that is, you know, the biggest challenge. Having said all of that, you know, I have a healthy respect for the fact that, you know, the best screening test is the screening test that a person is willing and able to do. So for some people, you know, stool tests are really the best option. You know, I think that the COVID pandemic really highlighted to us that there are going to be times where we can't do colonoscopy for whatever reason. You know, in 2020, it was because we shut down the procedure areas and we didn't have an option. So during that period of time, you know, we couldn't just stop screening our patients. So we relied heavily on stool-based screening options for patients. There are some patients who work hourly jobs. You know, they can't take a day off of work, you know, to come in and have a procedure done. They can't get a driver to bring them in. A stool-based test would be perfect and perfectly appropriate, again, for that average risk individual. For other individuals, they are very laser focused on making sure that they get that preventative test done. Well, for them, a colonoscopy is going to be the most appropriate test. But I tell, you know, providers and patients, you know, we should meet each other where we are. You know, for a patient who, you know, is very fearful about colonoscopy, does not want to have that done, we have another option. For our patients who, you know, very much want us to take a direct look at the lining of their colon, we'll meet them where they are. But I wouldn't want patients to opt out of being screened, because at the end of the day, getting screened and is the most important thing, the most critical factor.
How comfortable can someone feel after they've had the Cologuard results come back, or the FIT test results come back, to say that they don't have polyps? You're good for, what, another 5 years if you do a Cologuard, or is it 3 years?
So just in terms of terminology there, so a negative FIT test, a negative Cologuard test, tells us that you are unlikely to have colorectal cancer. Neither of those tests are polyp detection tests. That's okay. Only colonoscopy. And that's an important distinction because, again, those stool-based tests are sensitive and specific for true colorectal neoplasms or large polyps or tumors in the colon. They're not there to detect polyps.
Very important distinction, for sure.
Mm-hmm. But again, if a patient has a negative FIT or a negative Cologuard, a negative FIT once a year, negative Cologuard every 3 years, I tell them at least we have some reassurance, especially when these are being done on a sequential basis, that you are unlikely to have a significant problem in your colon. So as long as the patient is following that regimen and getting these recommended tests done at the recommended frequency, I think they can breathe easily.
Have you ever had anyone come in who had a Cologuard and then later was found to have cancer?
Absolutely. Oh. Again, no screening test is perfect. And I tell everybody that, you know, it's something that, you know, again, I keep reverting back to other forms of screening, you know, mammography, imperfect. You know, can they miss breast cancers? Absolutely. Can pap smears miss cervical cancer? Absolutely. But it's the reason that we get annual mammograms, or, you know, biannual mammograms, or annual pap smears. If we're doing these tests with the recommended cadence, we're less likely to miss a problem.
So the American Cancer Society reported last year that 20% of diagnoses in 2019 were in patients under the age of 55, which mm-hmm. is about double the rate from 1995. Now, with the number of young people having colon cancer rising, two respected organizations, and you mentioned this, they changed the guidelines. Mm-hmm. The preventive guidelines were once recommended to be for, 55 or age 50, and now they're 45. Mm-hmm. It sounds very logical. But would you like to see that get changed to an even younger age, maybe? I don't understand. Because, look, Chadwick Boseman still wouldn't have been qualified for the screening.
Absolutely.
When he got diagnosed. He died at age 43, got diagnosed.
Absolutely.
And 4 years earlier.
And any gastroenterologist sitting in this chair could tell you 20, 30, 50, 100 stories of patients who they've diagnosed at the age younger than 45. Again, these are recommended guidelines, but those guidelines are not going to encapsulate every person who has early onset colorectal cancer. It is a heartbreaking phenomenon because it's one that we can't readily explain. You know, it's one thing to say, well, a person has, you know, X, Y, and Z risk factors, and therefore they're at higher risk for, you know, getting colon cancer at age 30. We don't have a good explanation for that yet. It's something that is being, you know, very heavily scrutinized and very, very broadly studied. But the truth is, we don't have an answer for it yet. So again, you know, having patients understand that these are guidelines, that for sure, they shouldn't start screening later than age 45. But if they're having symptoms, having problems before then, not to ignore them. My youngest patient to date is actually a 26-year-old who had no antecedent, no known family history. Her PCP noted that she was anemic on her labs, but more anemic than he would have expected for a healthy 20, mid-20s something female. She came in February of 2020 and had her colonoscopy, and we found a transverse colon cancer. So, you know, again, we could lower the age to 40, right, to 35, but we still wouldn't capture some of these individuals. So following generic recommendations, well-meaning generic recommendations for colon cancer screening, is never going to be the whole story. It still falls to our team, primary care providers, patients, to escalate concerns when they're present.
So my son-in-law actually got a diagnosis at the age of 22, stage 4. He was a Marine. He had been treated at the time for colitis and inflammatory bowel, whatever. They probably couldn't imagine that it would be colon cancer to screen him. It was the last
Absolutely.
Test, obviously, that they gave him.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've been doing this 20 years this year, and when my career started, not that long ago in the grand scheme of things, if a 22-year-old came in with rectal bleeding and some belly pain, I would have assumed that, well, you know, maybe it's some colitis, maybe it's some hemorrhoids. It wouldn't have crossed my mind when I first started this that it could be a colorectal cancer. And 20 years later, you know, that same patient comes in, I'm concerned. I really am. And again, is it our food? Are there environmental factors? Are there, you know, changes in the genetics, you know, of our bodies? We don't have an answer for it, and it is deeply unsatisfying and worrisome. This is not to say that every person who has abdominal pain and rectal bleeding is going to have colorectal cancer. So I think that we want to avoid the other extreme as well, that every symptoms means the worst scenario. Not at all. I mean, common things are still common. And there's that old, you know, saying that we say, when you hear hooves, you think horses and not zebras. I mean, that is a classic for a reason, you know, because common things are still common. But I think having that dialogue, the dialogue with your family, the dialogue with your primary care, the dialogue with your gastroenterologist, to say, I have these symptoms, and in the context of everything else you know about me, what should I do? I think having that dialogue is critical.
Which is why we're here, for awareness. In the weeks and months since his death, an analysis of Google Trends and Wikipedia page views found that the search for colorectal cancer after Chadwick Boseman died, jumped nearly 600%.
Yeah.
We'll be very interesting to see in years to come if that spike in awareness does anything to the numbers of diagnosis and deaths.
It would be great if it would translate into more people getting screened. And, you know, I'll speak for my community when I say that there are a lot of African-American men in particular whose awareness of colorectal cancer, I mean, just skyrocketed after Chadwick's death. I think it hit home for a lot of young Black men, but a lot of people in general. And again, I think it's important to not live life in fear, right? Not live life alarmed at every symptom, but to understand that the landscape of colon cancer is changing. And so in that changing landscape, you know, how can I best take care of myself so that I minimize my own risk? You know, it's we definitely in my practice saw an upsurge, you know, in patients coming in with new concerns and new worries, and understandably so. But again, I think it's just as meaningful as it is to ensure that patients are getting screened, it's also meaningful to ensure that patients are not unnecessarily fearful. Talking to your primary care and talking to your gastroenterologist can hopefully, you know, put into a frame a person's individual symptoms, and then do that risk stratification, understand what is the level of concern for this person, and then proceed accordingly.
Well, since you brought up the primary care and the gastroenterologist part of it just now, how do patients come to see you? Do they come to you directly, or do they come to you through a primary care physician?
It's a mix. Some patients, you know, have the option to be seen by a specialist without a referral, and that's no problem. Other patients will go through their primary care provider. Whatever means a patient takes, whatever path they take to get to our office, really the outcome is the same. We're going to talk with the patient about their personal history, talk with them about their family history, get laboratory values when it's necessary, like do laboratory testing when it's necessary. And then again, we talk about diagnostic testing and screening options as appropriate. For those patients who come to us, they have a symptom or a problem, or an abnormal screening test, and they have a colonoscopy, we find a colorectal cancer. The name of the game is expedited, multidisciplinary, integrated care. So, you know, no patient is alone after that diagnosis. And I know that, you know, the first thing on a person's mind afterwards is, what next? What's going to happen to me? So the blessing of being at an integrated care center such as this is that the minute a patient has a new diagnosis of colorectal cancer, they are on to the next step. And I literally mean, when they're in that recovery area with, you know, covered up in their blanket and sipping some juice, I'm instantly talking to them about the next steps: imaging, labs, getting to see a surgeon, when appropriate, seeing an oncologist. So they don't leave the hospital that day without next steps in place.
Which would be pretty frightening if they didn't have some direction.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine getting...
Absolutely.
Well, we found 3 polyps and one's... Do you know right away if it has cancer?
You know, sometimes. Sometimes, you know, with enough experience, you can look at a polyp and say, this is worrisome, or you can look at one and say, this is nothing to worry about at all. And, you know, to the best of our capability, we do tell a patient on that day if we're concerned or not. But I think, you know, sometimes there's a fearfulness in terms of screening, just not knowing what will happen if the worst diagnosis does come. So I think it's important for patients to understand when they're, you know, getting care through their specialists, especially when they're coming to a multidisciplinary center, they're going to leave with answers. You know, once they get a diagnosis, if it is colorectal cancer, they're going to get escalated to the next steps and in an expedited fashion. And for those patients who, you know, have polyps or who have, you know, perfectly clean screening tests, they're going to get, you know, recommendations as well in terms of what to do next. I think it's, you know, knowledge is power, you know, and we want to empower our patients with understanding what is their next step.
Real quick, I've been wanting to ask this question forever. Wow. Is a gastroenterologist the same as a proctologist? If not, how are they different?
So, you know, I don't know that there are dedicated proctologists per se. So procto implies rectum. So that would be someone who just specializes in the rectum. I can't think of who that might be,
I didn't even know what that was.
So, you know, in my kind of old school understanding of that, as a proctologist is someone who like a colorectal surgeon, but obviously they do a whole lot more than just proctology.
It's an old term then.
It's a little antiquated.
Because I don't know any proctologists. I've never heard of any here at MedStar Health.
I think it's more of an outdated term these days.
Interesting. Good to know. So each year, close to 2 million people around the world are diagnosed with colorectal cancer, and more than 930,000 people die from it, according to the World Health Organization. Can it be prevented?
Yes. Understanding that not every colorectal cancer is preventable. Many are. From the standpoint of, again, understanding that family history, seeking help when there is a new symptom or a new concern, such as anemia, and ensuring that you're getting the colon cancer screening that's appropriate for you. In terms of the tests that we have available for screening, the only preventative test is that colonoscopy, because it's going to not only diagnose a polyp, diagnose a cancer, but it can also remove that polyp and that way be preventative against colorectal cancer.
Any final thoughts on what people need to know? What's the most important thing that you hope people will take away from this podcast?
Get screened. Doesn't matter what you do or what test you choose or how you get there, get screened and understand what your risk factors are. Again, we talk a lot. There's a lot of lip service, you know, eat a healthy diet and stop smoking, maintain a healthy weight. Do those things, of course, but get screened. Even if you have minimal risk factors, get screened. And it matters less what you choose to do, how you choose to do it. Just talk to your doctor about getting screened.
Does Benefiber count as fiber in your diet?
It sure does.
Okay, good.
It sure does. I tell my patients, fiber is kind of a triple whammy. It helps your lipids, your glucose, and it lowers your cancer risk.
Terrific. It's in my coffee every morning.
So I've got a free Benefiber commercial right there. But yeah, fiber is a good thing.
Thank you, Dr. Stone.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate
it. Thanks so much for your time and your expertise here on MedStar Health Doc Talk. To learn more about colorectal cancer, prevention, and detection, go to medstarhealth.org/cancer.